WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Suzanne Farrell, began dancing with the New York City Ballet more than 20 years ago. When she retired last year, critic Lord Schwartz described her as the most beloved dancer of his generation, and probably the greatest dancer George Balanchine ever worked with. Balanchine co-founded the New York City Ballet and became one of the century's most original choreographers. He was Farrell's mentor, and for several years was her closest companion. She writes about their relationship, on and off stage, in her new memoir, Holding On to the Air. Farrell was known for her ability to dance with the speed and musicality demanded by Balanchine's difficult ballets. I asked her what she thinks were her new contributions, the contributions she made during her years with the New York City Ballet.
I don't know. I think perhaps the fact that I was not interested in looking the same or capitalizing on a certain particular success that I had had in the past. I was not afraid of falling down and being human and making mistakes. And in fact, that's your laboratory. That's where everything happened, was in the studio. And he was very patient and demanding in the sense that he wanted you to do more so that you could become more what you were really like.
You said you weren't afraid of falling down. You even tell a story in your book about how dancing in Paris, your first move, you fell. You were on the floor just after the curtain opened.
Yes, well, I think it proved that I was not about to not be spontaneous and take a risk, even though I was in front of an audience who was unfamiliar with me.
Balanchine had told you, particularly for one dance, that he wanted you to dance off balance. This was for Don Quixote. What did that mean to you, dancing off balance, and is that something that you think you maintained long after that?
At the time, I really didn't know what he wanted because I was just trying to dance. And, of course, most dancers like to be well-placed, and you strive for perfection, and when you don't do what you want, it's always a little embarrassing. But I guess it was part of my childhood. I was a tomboy and didn't mind taking risks and was always in trouble somehow. So I guess part of that was my nature. And when he saw me be off balance and then recuperate and recover quickly, he liked that, found it interesting. And so in him pointing it out to me, it made me realize it. And eventually we took it even further than that.
You were one of the first ballet dancers to dance with your hair down. How did that come about?
Well, I was young, and I happened to have very long hair, and I think he liked that, and he thought it brought out a femininity, and for the particular ballets that he wanted to do at that time, I guess it was a new look, and also when I have my hair down, I move differently. It sometimes can act as a veil, or makes me feel more feminine. Sometimes it has its problems also, but it's a quite a different feeling. And I feel more vulnerable when my hair is down.
Suzanne Farrell is my guest, and she's written a new memoir called Holding On to the Air. You had an extraordinary relationship with George Balanchine. When did you first realize that he was singling you out, that he thought that you were a very special dancer and a very special person?
The first ballet he did for me, Meditation, was done in 1963, and I was 18, and he was 59 at the time. And, of course, I was very flattered and shocked that he had noticed me so much and was interested in doing something. Of course, it's every dancer's dream to have his attention and his love, but then you have to be responsible for what happens, and I had no idea that it would develop into what it did. Of course, there were ballets in between, and I guess it was Don Quixote that really started the intense friendship and affection we had for each other. And it was a ballet that he had wanted to do all his life. He had said that he didn't do it because he was searching for the right person, and he found it in me, and that's a very big honor, and we became close, so close to the point that we didn't know what was on stage, off stage, and things grew in many ways and grew backwards in many ways, and ultimately was pretty difficult. I nearly destroyed me at one time. On the other hand, dancing was our common bond. It was what we both had to do to be happy, and it's what brought us together. And we used to joke. I joked with him that if I weren't a dancer, he wouldn't even look at me. And he joked back and said, well, if I weren't a choreographer, you wouldn't look at me. So we took a long look at each other and started laughing. But no matter how intense things became, I always went back to dancing. We always worked together. It was a sanity and a salvation at the time of great stress.
Let's get back to 1963, when Balanchine was choreographing a dance for you and Jacques d'Amboise, and he wrote a love poem. Balanchine wrote a love poem and sent it to you and wrote, this is how Jacques should feel when he's dancing with you. And there was a P.S. in this note, and it said, I hope by now you are thin and beautiful and light to lift. Let's start with the love letter part, because it was pretty obvious to you that this was a love letter to you, although he said it was meant to describe what Jacques d'Amboise should be feeling. Did you know how to take it then?
No, not really. So because I was so confused, I just took it at face value as a poem about how our abstract characters were supposed to feel towards each other. And that did help in some ways. I had never been in love before, so it was hard for me to know how I would have to dance this ballet. But I guess it all came out in the choreography. And in a way, he choreographed our lives with the format of the ballet, a young girl appearing to an older man and dancing even more passionately as it goes on, and then her disappearing again. It was a very poignant ballet.
You think it was about his feelings for you?
Yes, absolutely. Even to the point where he eventually had Jacques put gray in his hair.
How did you respond to the P.S. of this love poem? The P.S. was, I hope by now you are thin and beautiful and light to lift.
Well, after reading such a beautiful poem, it was certainly a letdown to read it, to find out that was how he saw me. On the other hand, I suppose he knew more about me than I did at the time, and I was had these sort of baby fat cheeks from playing the clarinet when I was 18, and had to lose that. But I felt terrible that I was not yet what he wanted me to be, so I had to start working on it.
And how did you work on making your cheeks thinner?
I would draw in my cheeks and also try to lose weight. Eventually, it did come off.
One of the things Balanchine has been criticized for was trying to create ballerinas who were so thin that they had to be anorexic in order to stay at the weight that he wanted. Do you think that was a fair criticism?
Absolutely not. No, he never wanted that. He was a man who liked variety in his dancers, not only in the way they danced, but also in the physical way they looked. And if you go to the New York City Ballet, especially in those days, there were tall, voluptuous girls, there were short, thin girls, there were medium-height girls. Some of the ballets were even characterized as tall girl ballets or short girl ballets. He had roles that he loved women, and he spent his whole life celebrating women and putting them on a pedestal, and he always had different visions of them in his ballets. The Siren and Prodigal Son, she was very voluptuous and seductive, and certainly all the characters I played in Don Quixote were different, and never was there a man who wanted more diverse women to do ballets for than him.
It must have been a very difficult situation in a way when you were in your early 20s, in love with a man in his early 60s who was married, who was also your teacher. And I think when you're like 40 years younger than somebody and they're a master at what they do and they're your teacher, it would be virtually impossible to feel like an equal in the personal relationship. And I'm wondering what effect that had on you.
Well, it, It was emotionally difficult, but as any performer, any artist will tell you, they're all looking for someone for this type of collaboration. Actresses nowadays don't have anyone writing plays for them. Composers aren't writing operas for singers. This is, you know, practically the only time in this period in the theater where one man was doing all these ballets for one person. It was quite a unique opportunity and something that every performing artist looks for. And you can't make it happen. I think it's chemistry. I think it's fate. I think it's being there at the right time. It's a lot of things that you don't have any control over. And yet it's wonderful when it happens. And the pain, I think, is part of that process. And ultimately, it's worth it in the end.
I'm thinking of the insecurity that must come out, too. There's this great security, probably, in knowing that someone cares for you so much and is writing things, choreographing things, especially for you. And on the other hand, I just keep thinking about the personal part of being younger, less experienced.
Well, I think the fact that I was younger and I was clumsy in how I handled it. Mm-hmm. Not that an older person would have been able to handle those kind of emotions any easier. Mm-hmm. That's why maintaining my standard of dancing was so important to me, because if I lost that, then I really would have lost everything. And that was our real understanding, was our work.
Were you ever unsure what Balanchine wanted from the relationship with you?
No, I think ultimately he needed to choreograph to be happy to live. He would not talk about himself in terms of being a genius. He believed that God put him here, and this is what he was meant to do, and it would not occur to him not to do it. So I think he was very honest and clear that he was meant to work, and he needed inspiration.
So you felt that you were his muse in a lot of ways?
He said that, yes. Which is a pretty perilous place to be, especially when when as a young girl you want to work with this man and you want to be everything that he wants in a dancer, and then when suddenly you find that that is what he wants, it's sort of a dream that you're unprepared to live with as a human being.
You were in the position of reading in the Chicago Sun-Times that Balanchine had said that you were engaged. And you knew nothing about this. Did you want to marry?
I wanted to dance at that particular time. I don't know. I don't really know what I wanted at that time. I don't even know if he did. It all got so confusing.
I want to ask you about something an incident that you describe in your memoir, Holding On to the Air. You said that there was a period when Balanchine had been very depressed, and someone in the company had said to you, what's wrong? And you confessed that you weren't going out together. So this person suggested that you start seeing him again. And then a prominent male dancer in the company said to you, why don't you just sleep with him? It doesn't have to mean anything. Is it such a big deal? What was your reaction to that?
I was, of course, shocked. That was just not the way I could live my life. And also, he was married. And I believe our relationship was very much on a spiritual level. He was a very spiritual man. He had to be. You can look at his ballets and see that he felt that he was in service to a higher ideal and to God, and that complicated matters. He, of course, was married.
You ended up getting married to somebody else, to someone who was also a dancer, who was a couple of years younger than you. What were the repercussions when you were married? And I should say that Balanchine had gotten a divorce just 2 weeks before that.
Well, this was a difficult period. I felt that if I continued dancing as well as I could, and that he was still happy with my dancing, that eventually things would all iron out and become good again, because I always wanted to be there for him and to be the dancer that he wanted me to be. But eventually, and quite understandably now when we look back, he didn't want to have Paul in the company anymore and started taking ballets away from him. And it became clear that things were not going to get any better. And actually, I'm convinced that it was necessary to leave the company. The only way we ever were to have survived was to separate.
So you were basically, you and your husband were basically exiled from the company. You were around 23, I think, when you left.
Yes.
And you say that you were afraid other companies weren't hiring you. Other companies weren't hiring you, and you say that you think one of the reasons why was that they didn't want to alienate Balanchine because they had Balanchine dances in their repertoire and they wanted more. Do you think that Balanchine would have punished them by withholding new dances had they hired, had one of these companies hired you as a dancer?
I don't really know, but emotions were very high at the time, and no one was acting very noble or sensibly, and it's a possibility. On the other hand, it was after you've had the New York City Ballet and Balanchine, which to me always was and always will be the best place to dance, whether I was a member of the company or not, I never changed my belief in him. It was really best to go to Europe and not stay in America. There was just, everything else was just not as good as I had, and it was time to move on.
How did you get back to the New York City Ballet?
We had been vacationing in upstate New York. We had purchased an island. Strangely enough, after we left the company, it was the most bizarre thing to do because we didn't have a future job in sight, didn't have any money, and things were not looking very good for us at the time in terms of finance and future. But we happened to visit that area, and an island was for sale, and I guess we felt that we just had to have roots somewhere, so we bought it. So then what happened was that we immediately moved to Europe, so we never got there. But during the summers, we would go and visit, and it's only about 2 hours from Saratoga Springs, where the company, New York City Ballet, would have its summer home and were performing. And I was eager to see what had been happening, what new ballets Balanchine had come up with, and to see some of my friends and to sort of just go back to where I had spent my summers in the past as a member of the New York City Ballet. So we went to a performance, and I saw a beautiful ballet, La Valse, which I had done many times before I left the company. And when I got back home, I was so happy to see such good dancing and to see such a beautiful ballet, and it brought back a lot of feelings, a lot of memories, and I just felt compelled to write him a letter and say, Dear George, as wonderful as it is to see your ballets, it's even more wonderful to dance them. Is this impossible? And so it was probably the shortest letter I ever wrote him, and a couple days later, I had a phone call saying that from his secretary saying that Mr. Balanchine would like to see me in New York. So on my way back to Europe, we got together and talked. He opened the door. It was like old times. We hugged each other, and it was basically, well, when do we get back to work? I think we had both changed and were eager and ready to get back to work again.
Was your relationship different when you started dancing with the ballet again?
Not really. We were still comfortable in the studio together. We laughed. I had a great fun re-exploring his repertoires and his training because it was different from where I had come from in Europe. Ballet was always our real heart and soul and center of what our lives were, and it was the air we breathed and our understanding. So it was, in a way, really like coming home.
What about your husband? Did he ever come back? I know he was never hired back by the company, but did he feel comfortable coming over even to pick you up or something?
Oh, sure. He came to the ballet and was happy to see me again. It was a time when we all knew that I was meant to be here, and it was great to be back.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with ballerina Suzanne Farrell, who's written a memoir called Holding On to the Air. You write that when Balanchine died, you wondered if you wanted to dance anymore?
Well, I knew I would not be understood in the same way that Balanchine understood me. And so much of our life was together. And when he died, Well, I never thought he would die. I believed in him so much. He used to say he's Georgian from the Georgian part of Russia, Tbilisi. He said, we live forever. We live to be 100. And he was right in so many other situations, so I thought he would live to be 100. So I was totally unprepared when his health got so bad and it became clear that he was not going to get better. I missed him greatly when he died. I still miss him. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book was because I missed him. It was a way of holding on to him and keeping my sanity. And a lot had been written about us, and I wanted to set the record straight. On the other hand, if I were to run into him on the street now, it would be very normal. I still feel his presence so much. And so I do have him in my life all the time, every time I stage ballets, even in my normal life. He's taught me so much.
You retired from dancing in 1989. How does it feel to not be performing?
I love to dance, and I think maybe one of my problems is that I never got bored with my work. Actually, that's not a problem. It's a privilege. But it did leave me wondering, since my hip operation, what it would be like to live without dancing in my life, and also without music. Music is the main thrust of why I love to dance. And I knew that I would not be able to dance again, but I didn't know if I'd be able to listen to music and not be able to want to dance again. So I started staging ballets, and I went to Leningrad and did Scotch Symphony for the Kirov dancers. And it was an acid test for me because I wasn't quite sure that I would be able to be open with everything I had learned, whether I would wish I were up there dancing, whether I would be able to teach them and get from them what they were meant to give and not impose myself so much. I think it's hard to make the transition, but finally, in the end, I was so fulfilled teaching the ballet to someone. And I guess the tendency often is to pick someone to do your part that looks like you, that you feel you have an affinity for, or you see yourself in. And I was happy that I didn't do that. It was a smaller dancer and different kind of legs, different physique, but she was wonderful, and she wanted to be there. And I was happy that I could tell her everything I know, and we could go on, and I wasn't missing not being on stage. And I felt equally as exhausted or fulfilled sitting in the audience watching them and knowing that they put their trust in what I said and I put my trust in them. It was really wonderful.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And my guest has been Suzanne Farrell. Her new autobiography is called Holding On to the Air. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.